I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now from Denver, where Democrats await another big night. Hillary Clinton is set to speak amid reports that the party is so nervous about how her disappointed backers will respond that the DNC is considering changing Wednesday night's roll call. We'll try to get to the bottom of that today. Also, columnist Ellen Goodman is here to talk about the nexus of politics and gender. And we'll hear from some very angry Clinton supporters here in Denver. But first, news of a different sort from Colorado today. Denver police are scheduled to speak at 4 p.m. Mountain Time about the Sunday arrest of four people in a Denver suburb. They are now suspected of plotting to shoot Barack Obama at his Thursday night acceptance speech. Chilling words. One of the men arrested was interviewed last night by KCNC-TV here in Denver. Reporter Brian Moss broke that story for the CBS affiliate. Brian, we saw your reports here in Denver very early this morning. Who is the man you interviewed?
Robin, we interviewed Nathan Johnson. He's one of the men who was wrapped up by police early Sunday morning in this apparent plot to assassinate Senator Obama.
We understand it was just a traffic stop, and what did they find in the car?
What happened was early Sunday morning, police in Aurora, one of the suburbs of Denver, pulled a guy over who was driving a bit erratically, 28-year-old Theron Gartrell. But when they went inside of his car, they found some things that were very unusual: a bulletproof vest, two rifles with scopes on them, ammunition, walkie-talkies, drugs, a couple of wigs, a spotting scope, IDs that belonged to other people, camouflage clothing, and part of a pistol. Authorities somehow went from there and believed there was some sort of plot afoot to assassinate Senator Obama. And they went to two other hotels in the early morning hours of Sunday and arrested two other people, including Nathan Johnson, the man I interviewed.
Well, Nathan Johnson spoke to you about what his friends were saying about Barack Obama. Let's listen to a little of what you heard.
He don't belong in political office, or blacks don't belong in political office. He ought to be shot.
So that's what Nathan Johnson said his friends were saying, but did he say that they were going to kill Barack Obama?
You know, he went back and forth. He said they had sort of talked about it, maybe talked hypothetically about if we were going to do this or if I were going to do this, I'd do it from a high vantage point. Here's how I would do it. He said at some points that he didn't think they were capable of it, and he didn't really think it was a plot. Maybe it was just loose talk. But he said they had certainly spoken hypothetically about how they would do it, their hatred for Senator Obama, and their disappointment that an African-American might be a presidential candidate.
Right now, authorities are downplaying this. It doesn't really come as a surprise. The U.S. Attorney's Office released a statement saying there is no credible threat to Obama. But that seems different from saying there was not a credible threat to Obama. What is your sense of how credible they thought this alleged threat was?
Well, I can tell you this. When I interviewed Mr. Johnson late last night, he said that he'd been interviewed a couple of times now by federal authorities about all this on Sunday after he was arrested. Then he said yesterday on Monday they interviewed him for about 8 hours, including a FBI polygraph test. I asked him what they said when the day was over and all the interviews were done, and he said that they told him the polygraph indicated that he knew more than he was telling them. And frankly, that was the sense I got coming away from the interview with him, that there were things he wasn't telling me that were germane.
But, Brian, if this was indeed a plot to try to kill a presidential candidate, you know, just a chilling sentence even to form, why did police let you talk to this suspect?
Well, he has First Amendment rights. If someone's in jail and they sign a consent form, they're allowed to speak to the media.
In the current climate, people have been kept from speaking to the press, so I just wondered if you were at all surprised by that, but you weren't. Well, what happens next in this case?
As you cited, Robin, their initial inclination was to say there's no credible threat here. However, when you have suspects like these, all with criminal records, high-powered rifles with scopes, all of the other items found in that vehicle, and then the plot or the discussions recounted by Nathan Johnson, when you put all that together, it's easy to see why this was viewed or may still be viewed as a very real situation.
Brian Moss, investigative reporter for CBS4 here in Denver. Brian, thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
So, back to the convention. And the question everyone is asking here, what will Hillary Clinton say and do tonight? And will anything she says sway her most disgruntled supporters who say they are voting for John McCain? The McCain campaign is capitalizing on that. With this ad running constantly here in Denver, it stars a purported Hillary supporter waving her Hillary placard.
I'm a proud Hillary Clinton Democrat. She had the experience and judgment to be president. Now, in a first for me, I'm supporting a Republican, John McCain.
The woman goes on to say, a lot of Democrats are going to vote for McCain. It's okay, really. Well, joining us from our Boston studios, Ellen Goodman, Pulitzer Prize-winning Boston Globe syndicated columnist, a veteran observer of politics and how politics intersects or doesn't with women's issues. Her columns carried in over 300 newspapers. Ellen, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you.
And what do you make of these Clinton supporters turned McCain voters? What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, in journalism, they always say you find three people and you have a trend, you know. So I think there's still really a small number. And that doesn't mean that there aren't a lot of disaffected Hillary voters or disappointed and disaffected or just disappointed, because there are. I mean, this has been a long cause as much as a campaign. And for a lot of older women in particular, it looked like that might be the bookend of their life and the hope that they would see a woman in the White House.
Well, according to the latest USA Today Gallup poll, only half of the voters who supported Hillary say they're going to definitely vote for Obama. That's very bad math right now for Obama. And we wondered if we were, you know, as media, maybe making too much of a natural tension between rival camps. So we went to the headquarters of what the group that was called PUMA. It was the party United My Butt. They've changed it to People United Means Action. They want Hillary Clinton to be the nominee, but they want the caucus system changed. Barack Obama this weekend asked the Democratic Party to reexamine the system, but the PUMAs want caucuses abolished. Let's listen.
We should have a secret ballot where there are not people pushing you, shoving you, knocking you, yelling at you.
Do you think the caucuses are one of the reasons that Hillary Clinton did not win this nomination?
Yes, Barack Obama stole all the caucuses, in my opinion.
So now Barack Obama is saying, I want those caucuses investigated, maybe changed. He's also saying,
and we're supposed to believe this guy who has flip-flopped on everything? Are we supposed to count on him for anything? He'll say anything to get elected?
You guys are obviously so angry, but you know how you're being used by the Republicans who have put out an ad, backing your opinion.
Why isn't we were used by the DNC? You don't think that the DNC, they said, go and vote, campaign, get out there and pick your person, go and vote a secret ballot. And those people in Florida and Michigan voted a secret ballot, and then what happened? The DNC took their votes away from them. Now, you don't think, yes, we're angry.
Yes.
We're absolutely angry.
You are saying some tough things about the Democratic Party candidate. This
is
your party.
It's time for it to change. Don't the Democratic Christ. Party is no longer the Democratic Party when they act worse than the Republican Party did in the year 2000.
It would be fine if they said, we're just going to go ahead and pick our guy. We're just going to have caucuses in every state, and we're going to go ahead and pick our guy. That is not what they said. They said, we want your input. We want everybody to be involved. We want people to go out and vote. And then they pulled the rug out from under Hillary and totally changed the rule.
I've been a Democrat all my life, and as have most of the women in this room and men. We stuffed the envelopes. We walked the precincts, knocking on doors. We've organized the luncheons, whatever needed to be done. As a Democratic Party, we're supposed to be inclusive. There should be a place at the table for everyone. We have worked at that to make sure that happened for years and years and years. And suddenly we're told, goodbye, move away from the table. We don't need any of you anymore. And besides, you're a bunch of whiny, racist,
bitter.
Oh, yeah, ugly,
gun-clinging,
overweight, gun-clinging, and all of you, please leave.
But give us your money first, please.
Yes.
Give us your money.
Here's a perfect example of why we're angry. And it's not even really about Obama or Hillary at this point. It's about the DNC.
Yeah,
in Michigan, when the Rules and Bylaws Committee met and they redistributed the delegates, They gave Barack Obama the uncommitted delegates, which is actually a recognized status on the ballot. Then they took it one to, and you could kind of make the argument, okay, maybe, because there was a push for his people to go out and vote uncommitted so that Hillary didn't get all the vote, perceptually, maybe. But then they took it one step further and took four delegates away from Hillary Clinton and gave them to Barack Obama. Those delegates represent 600,000 people's votes.
Yes.
They literally, in the most fundamental way, changed people's votes. Once a party can do that, you've lost the country.
What are you going to do? What are you going to do over the course of the week? I mean, it seems as if the train is leaving.
The train has just hit the station, because we are committed to making changes in this party, to making our party again inclusive of all people. We're not a group of negative people. We are very positive. We care very much, and the train hasn't left the station.
Are you not going to vote, or are you going to vote for McCain?
McCain all the way.
Really?
No Obama. No Obama.
Wait a minute. How many are going to vote for McCain? Almost the whole room.
I would rather run against McCain in 4 years than Obama. Amen.
My father is 80 years old. He is a lifelong Democrat. He's never voted anything but Democratic Party. And he's voting for McCain.
Yes.
And I want to say one thing. My next door neighbor, who, bless her soul, died recently. She called me. She was in terminal cancer. She went down and manned the phones for Hillary. Every chance she could. She was one of the volunteers that, even though she was dying, she went down there and made phone calls. And she called me about 3 weeks ago, and she said, "Edith, how do I vote Republican? This woman has never done anything but vote Democratic in her life, and she wanted to know, how do I vote Republican?"
That's our visit to PUMA headquarters here in Denver. And we should mention the DNC says that both the Obama and Clinton camps agreed to the divvying up of delegates from Michigan, one of the thorns in the side of the PUMA activists. Ellen Goodman, I asked these women, you heard the passion, and I asked them, are you really going to vote for John McCain, even though he is anti-choice and has pledged to appoint anti-choice Supreme Court judges? Their response was yes. Your thoughts?
Well, it reminds me of the old women's movement slogan, the personal is political, but it's a little too personal, or the political is personal, a little too personal at this moment. And certainly I agree that the primary setup, I mean the primaries and the caucuses, who could figure it out, Robin? You couldn't figure it out, and
no.
I couldn't figure out what was going on. So it's a particularly crazy state-by-state system.
But that doesn't mean that...
You should want to, if you're, for example, pro-choice, vote for someone who has a 0% record with narrow pro-choice America. Doesn't mean that you give up issues because of being mad at the DNC.
That's syndicated columnist Ellen Goodman. We're going to take a minute break. Ellen, when we come back, I want to ask you what you think Hillary Clinton has to say tonight and how you feel about the sentiment that it is her job to pull the party together tonight. We'll have more in a minute with Ellen Goodman. Later in the program, Damon Runyon's Denver. Back in 1 minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're back in Denver with more from Pulitzer Prize-winning syndicated columnist Ellen Goodman of the Boston Globe, ahead of Hillary Clinton's much-anticipated speech tonight here at the Democratic Convention. And Ellen Goodman, I want to pick up where we were. The question that's being asked here is, what does Hillary Clinton have to say tonight to unite the party, to bring aboard maybe not the very angry women we just heard from, it doesn't seem like anything Hillary Clinton says will dissuade them, but the women who are maybe on the fence about voting for Barack Obama. But I also want to ask, how do you feel about the fact that that's the question, that it's Hillary Clinton's job to somehow finesse this tonight?
Well, I think she's being put in a typically female role, that she's now responsible for mediating and peacemaking and conciliatory action. I mean, it is, after all, Obama has to win them over. That doesn't mean that she doesn't have to do the traditional gracious and welcoming act where she, I don't mean act in a theatrical sense, but speech where she engages and tells her supporters that it is time for them to vote for Obama and praises Obama very much. But I am a little resisting the notion that it's her job, and if it doesn't happen, she's somehow failed in delivering her vote. These are independent people who we've seen in many previous campaigns, supporters of one candidate, found it hard to switch over to another candidate. And remember, too, you know, Obama, during this campaign, in many ways, he took on the traditional female voice. We had he was considered to be the Oprah candidate. He was the conciliator, the bring us all, the uniter, not divider.
But has he said all he can say now?
No. I frankly think it would be wonderful to hear him talk more using his mother's life, his mother's story, which ran the entire arc of the generational narrative of women's lives, using his mother's story, talking about his grandmother, as he has written about a little bit in his book, and saying exactly that what kind of a president, what he would mean for women in this country. I don't think he's done that in as eloquent and fulsome a way as he could have.
Well, you've written that what Clinton supporters should do is get even. What do you mean?
Well, get even does not mean revenge. Get even means to get the playing field even. 24 years ago, I remember interviewing Geraldine Ferraro before she was nominated to be vice president. And in her office, there was something called the Women's Campaign Game on the wall. And it said, you're twice as qualified as your opponent. You've worked twice as hard. The two of you are now dead even. So we have to, for example, how different would this campaign have been if there were three women running instead of one? How different would the feelings of those women from Puma be if there had been three women? How different would it have been if we had really had a much less sexist media coverage of this campaign? I don't think it's any. You don't have to be a Hillary supporter. You certainly don't have to be a member of Puma to have been appalled at the all the ghastly stuff, you know,
from the
Hillary
and,
nutcracker and the
right.
and the B word, which you will
right.
not do on public radio,
right.
and
right.
on and on. So you have to get that playing field, and the DNC was not good about calling people, and broadcasters were not good about calling people on those. So, and also getting more women into the political pipeline.
Well, you talk about preparing a farm team of feminist candidates, and you also remind us of other times when women's movement activists might have felt a setback. For instance, the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings, when women felt that Anita Hill was treated poorly. But you remind us that what followed were the conventions of 92, and in November of that year, four women added to the Senate.
Yes, it was the year of the woman. I think it was actually six. New women senators, but that was considered to be the year of the woman because prior to that, during the Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill hearings, there was this recognition that there was no woman on the Senate Judiciary Committee. Who was out there representing women, and it really did motivate a lot of good anger. I mean, there's anger that is useful and motivating, and there's anger that is just self-destructive, and you shoot yourself in the foot.
I just, you know, we've got a couple minutes left here with Ellen Goodman of the Boston Globe. Tell us about your first convention, 1972.
Well, my first convention in 1972, I was sent because there was a, quote, woman's story, and I was a very young reporter. I'd like to say I was a teenage reporter, but I wasn't. I was a very young reporter, and the Boston Globe sent me to cover it because they needed a woman, end quote, to cover it. And
to cover
Shirley
the
Chisholm
story.
Was running for president there, unbossed and unbowed, remember?
Mm-hmm.
And she made an impassioned speech and had her name put in for vice president and had a roll call vote. Then we think roll call votes are somewhat new right now, but of course they're not. And it was really quite a dramatic moment. And that was one of the first of you kind of would track the baseline of women in politics from that moment to the Ferraro campaign. And now there is some, I must say, I thought Michelle Obama was quite wonderful last night. But again, the notion was that this is the ascendant woman now and is the wife. And the headlines were, Michelle Obama humanizes husband. So that's where women are, which is in a much more traditional role, certainly than Michelle Obama has occupied in her life, or even in the campaign, where often she seems sort of like a feisty sitcom kind of wife.
Well, we still have to wait and see what happens tonight. You mentioned the power of the roll call in 72. It might be quite powerful tomorrow night. There's debate, and we're going to hear about that next, about whether or not to even have the roll call, if it becomes too divisive. What will Hillary Clinton's backers do if there's a televised roll call on the floor? There's a question of whether they might do the roll call at private breakfast. Ellen Goodman, syndicated columnist from the Boston Globe, I know you're watching this all closely. Thanks for sharing some of your thoughts with us.
Thank you, Robin.
We'll have that debate over, apparently a debate over how to hold the roll call tomorrow night ahead. Also ahead, Senator John Kerry. He was swift voted 4 years ago. What are his thoughts about what Obama should do now? We'll be back after the news here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now from Denver on day two of the party nominating convention. And you'd think by now the question of exactly how Barack Obama would be nominated in a roll call vote tomorrow night would be settled. But reportedly it's not. And it's not for lack of trying. According to the Denver Post, intense negotiations are underway with the Hillary Clinton campaign. Obama and Clinton are reportedly working out a plan for delegates to cast their votes at breakfast at their hotels tomorrow morning. And then those votes would be reflected in a roll call later that night. It's an idea that's infuriating some Hillary Clinton supporters. Peter Walston covers politics for the Los Angeles Times. And Peter, the roll call where every state gets to stand up and people, delegates get to say who they're casting their vote for, that's, a big part of the convention. What do you make of this story in the Denver Post that roll call might actually be taken at breakfast?
Well, it's certainly one of the scenarios that we're hearing about. There's a number of options on the table. The two sides are as you said, in intense negotiations. I think from what we're hearing, we are going to, viewers will see something resembling a roll call that they're accustomed to, that is the tradition. Now, the question is, one idea that has been floated is that the roll call would proceed through several states, and then at a certain point, perhaps after New York, be stopped, and then Obama be nominated through unanimous consent of every delegate in the hall.
Well, in that story, by the way, I'm just going to jump in to say that in that version, manipulating the number of votes in the states so that by the time it gets to New York, he's over the top. I've heard that in that case, Hillary Clinton would be the one who would put his name in nomination. It's her state.
Yeah, that's possible. That's been discussed. She's going to do several public pronouncements to that effect. And there's also a discussion of a private meeting she'll have with delegates tomorrow, where she will publicly call on them to switch their votes from her to him. And she, in fact, will cast her vote for Barack Obama.
And by the way, just remind us, is this when she would officially release them? And doesn't she legally have to do that, release them to be free to vote not for her, but for Obama?
Well, that's also something that seems to be in dispute or is different based on who you talk to. Some people think that she would have to legally release them. Other people say that the national rules supersede the state rules, and delegates are still free to vote for whomever they wish. I just think people here are unaccustomed to this not being set well in advance.
Right. Well, we understand Clinton delegates are furiously circulating petitions to try to stop any breakfast roll call. But Politico.com is writing that it's Hillary Clinton who's now anxious about the floor roll call vote. Why? Why might she be anxious?
Why would she be anxious? She, first of all, there's a couple of things at stake here for her. One is you don't want to go through a roll call and wind up with an embarrassingly few number of votes if you're Hillary Clinton. But on the other side, you don't want to look as though you're dividing the convention. She has her own, not only her husband's legacy here to worry about, but her own political future. You know, Hillary Clinton would very much like to run for president again in 4 years, possibly 8 years. If Obama were to lose to McCain this time around, Hillary Clinton will be obviously the one of the leading candidates for president in 4 years. She doesn't want to anger the base, especially African Americans, and we found in the last couple of days that not only are the Hillary Clinton supporters angry at what's going on, but now we're hearing from the Barack Obama supporters who are angry about what's happening, and specifically African American supporters who feel that the Clintons are not doing enough to help Barack Obama, that they're not they feel that the Clintons could stop all of this immediately and just say, look, it's finished, it's over. We're now wholeheartedly supporting Barack Obama, and that's it. Forget it. You're making all of us look bad.
Well, a couple things. We just heard from some Clinton supporters who said it's beyond Clinton. It's out of her control, and they aren't responding to her. But we also know, we spoke to some delegates, one from Montana, who's one of the floor whips she's lined up. Hillary Clinton has lined up 40 floor whips, and their job is to try to keep supporters in line. And the Montana delegate we spoke to is going to do that grudgingly tomorrow night. But I want to talk about some of your writing and expand a little. Bill Clinton expected to speak the next night here in Denver. You spoke with a party leader who says the question isn't whether America is ready for a black president, it's whether the Clintons are ready for this black president. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, well, that was a comment made by former Virginia Governor Doug Wilder, who was the first elected black governor in the country, and now is actually still involved in politics. He's the mayor of Richmond. Virginia is a battleground state as far as the Obama campaign is concerned, and Wilder is a very enthusiastic supporter of Senator Obama. He's extremely frustrated. I was actually in our conversation taken aback at his question there. I think he feels that the Clintons are getting in the way of history here. And he said it was Doug Wilder who made the point that, yes, it's true that the Clintons are saying publicly they'll support Obama and they'll probably give speeches that will sound gracious tonight and tomorrow night. But, you know, it's not what happens in the convention hall. He said it's what happens in the meetings on the sidelines here. It's what happens in the personal phone calls, in the exhortations that he thinks are not coming from the Clintons to their most vocal supporters to really get behind Obama. So he's very upset about this.
Well, it puts the Clintons in perhaps a particularly tough spot because, they come from a region where he was in Arkansas where they embraced by blacks. He was, as we know, called the first black president. And I'm reading in Politico.com, I've got it up here right now, that the psychology of the week is complicated. It requires the Clintons to muzzle what friends say are their deep and continuing doubts about Obama's electability, qualifications, and political character, that they sincerely have those doubts, and yet when they've expressed them, they've been called racist, which is anathema to them.
Yes, it's extremely difficult for them. They're very bitter, apparently. If you talk to the Clintons' close advisors, the resentment there is not very deep below the surface. They're very angry that they feel that they've been painted as the ones playing the race card here in this dispute. They feel that that's an important part of Bill Clinton's legacy is the racial reconciliation that took place during his tenure, and to a certain extent they just want the Obamas to acknowledge that. At least that's what they say. Now, I think there's also an extent here, I talked to a couple other Democratic leaders yesterday who made the point that, look, you know, they've dominated this party for 16 years. They're just having a hard time letting go. And that's part of the psychology as well. And I think that that's something else Doug Wilder was getting at in our conversation was that it's kind of beyond race, too. It's not just that they're not ready for the first black president. It's perhaps that they're not ready for a president, Democratic president not named Clinton.
As the Politico writes, not ready to be sunset figures exiting stage right. That's Peter Walston, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times. Peter, thanks so much as always.
Oh, you're welcome, Robin. It's a pleasure to be with you.
And a quick reminder, you can download our conversation and our podcast. Take us with you wherever you go at here-now.org. You are listening to Here and Now.
I pledge to you that I will be there next January on the floor of the United States Senate.
Well, last night, the Lion of the Senate roared when an ailing Senator Ted Kennedy asked the party faithful to follow him into battle. But will they be able to mount the necessary fight? 4 years ago, Senator John Kerry, then the Democratic presidential nominee, was criticized for not taking on the Swift Boat detractors. The same author who attacked Kerry, Jerome Corsi, has now written a book about Barack Obama called The Obama Nation, which makes widely discredited claims such as Obama has tried to cover up extensive connections to Islam. Well, we caught up with Senator Kerry yesterday at Denver's famous Brown Palace Hotel as he dashed between events. This week, Kerry said the Democrats have to more viscerally define John McCain. We asked, what do you mean by that?
Well, I think that John McCain has been defining himself as a, quote, maverick who somehow is not in step with his party, and nothing could be further from the truth. He voted with George Bush 95% of the time last year.
Do you think that's still true? Because it seems as if he is embracing the surge and his relationship with George Bush.
Well, the surge has not accomplished the purpose of the surge. Nobody doubted that additional effort by American troops would have the ability to be able to provide additional security in places. We all knew that. The question is, can you get a sufficiently independent Iraqi army and Iraqi security situation that you could begin to draw down American troops?
Is that, though, a dangerous position for Democrats, given that I meet a lot of Democratic voters who say, wait a second, that's not the question. The Democrats are allowing the Republicans to make the surge, and whether it succeeds the issue, the question should still be, should we have gone to war?
Well, it's not only should we, it should we still be there? I mean, look, you're there. The question now is, what are the security interests of the United States of America, and how do you meet those needs? That's the judgment that ought to be at issue here, and that's what we think we ought to define for, you know, when you define John McCain, you define somebody who is wrong on the economy.
On that note, we are staying at a Howard Johnson's restaurant about 45 minutes out of town with a karaoke country bar with some people that we've gotten very fond of.
Sounds cool.
It's actually terrific, but they are living the songs they're singing. Their wages haven't increased in decades. They don't have health benefits. Right. Why aren't they Democrats?
Because some of the cultural issues have been exploited very effectively by the Republicans over the last years, and I think we've now learned a lot of lessons. I think that this will be different in 08. I think we're going to approach it differently. I think we're going to talk to those folks a lot more and spend a lot more time reaching out to them than we've been able to. Remember, when I ran, we were limited in the numbers of states we could go run in because we had federal financing and it wasn't enough money. As it was, I had to pull out of three states. How can you run for president of the United States when you can't even go everywhere? But Barack Obama is outside of that system because he has a grassroots organization that is supporting him. And so we're going to be able to go out and campaign in a lot more places, and I think that's a big difference.
I want to ask you something about John McCain, who's getting roughed up this week because of the number of homes he owns. He's a Vietnam vet who married an heiress. You're a Vietnam vet who married an heiress. I wonder, you know, how you feel when you hear that criticism.
It's tragic for the American political process. That's not what this is about. This is about ideas. All the rest of that stuff is really just junk.
I want to show you something that I've been carrying around since 2006. This is a cartoon. There's a couple, see, watching a television there, and there's a news announcer saying, can torture-mad, warmongering, crony capitalist theocrats work with terrorist-coddling, Hollywood values, tax-and-spend stem cell killers? We find out after this. Now, you're laughing, but this is the divide. How do you break that?
Barack Obama has broken it. Barack Obama has offered an unbelievably constructive, positive campaign for the presidency. And people are now complaining because he hasn't come back with the same kind of Karl Rove tactics of the Republicans. Well, you know, if they want to fight fire with fire, we may have to do it. But
yeah, but you didn't do it, and the same author has written a book about him. Do Democrats have to do it?
That author wouldn't know the truth if he stumbled over it. That book is so filled with lies, as was the book they wrote about me. It's shocking. It's amazing to me. And if it weren't for the public laws that we have that govern lawsuits with respect to that, they'd be sued up the gazette.
But it's number one. Do Democrats have to get out harder about
Democrats
it?
Democrats have to fight back hard. Yes.
Massachusetts Senator John Kerry. In 1 minute, Damon Runyon's Denver. That's coming up here and now. I'm I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now in Denver.
Welcome. Go ahead and take your ticket out of here and have it scanned at the door.
This past weekend, the DNC held a bash for the thousands of journalists here. Lucky us, it was at Elitch Gardens. This is the lovely downtown amusement park that's part of the Denver skyline and was the site of the press party at Denver's first Democratic convention 100 years ago. William Jennings Bryan was the Democrats' nominee in 1908, and one of the reporters covering the story, a young Damon Runyon. Yes, before he moved to New York and wrote stories like Guys and Dolls that launched 1,000 tabloid imitators, Damon Runyon was a Denver reporter. Raised in Pueblo, Colorado, his mother died when he was young, his father was an alcoholic and a newspaper man, and Damon Runyon became both as well. I wondered last Saturday, could he have stood right where I was 100 years ago?
I was thinking about that.
That's reporter John Insulin of the Rocky Mountain News, historian of the Denver Press Club, which every year gives out the prestigious Damon Runyon Award to a top journalist and cherishes his role in their past. During a stroll past the carousels and beer halls of Elitch Gardens, they asked why.
Damon Runyon did cover this convention in 1908. In fact, here are some of his articles from that.
Oh, look at that.
They're wonderful. Look at this, the headline, City Beautiful, in color, ready for a final rush. Every visitor made happy by open-handed hospitality and cool weather.
Now, I see irony there through a 2008 prison, but was it there then?
You should see the irony. There was a certain amount of boosterism, which all the papers back then prevailed upon.
But was he doing it?
Well, he wrote the following. These are his words. We are now just about all ready for 4 years ago, and whereas the Democratic Party, but we're waiting for a couple of other delegations which have become lost somewhere out in Kansas or among the decorations on Lower 17th before getting down to this business of making vast demonstrations at the mention of certain names. That's a lead that probably wouldn't have survived in a modern newspaper, but I love it because it's colorful, it's rambunctious, it's vivid.
Look at his byline, Alfred Damon Runyon.
Damon Runyon. Now, this was a young man, basically. His stories are still a little raw and rough around the edges. He hadn't really mastered the art of writing yet, and he hadn't dropped his original first name. So he was going by Alfred Damon Runyon, and eventually when he left Denver and headed for New York and the fame and glory that followed him there, he dropped the Alfred.
Now, I heard that an editor in New York told him only Protestants have three names.
An editor told me only criminals have three names.
So we know who Damon Runyon was when he was in New York. We know the Guys and Dolls, Damon Runyon. Right. But what was Runyon-esque when he was a Denver writer?
Runyon-esque when he got to Denver? Well, for one thing, he drank himself out of a job. He came to the press club, he would drink North Platte beer, which was the name of the brand back then. And he'd get drunk, he'd get stewed, he'd get to the point where he could barely write. But he was a gifted writer. He had the knack for putting you in the place that he was at. He had great descriptive writing in an era where there was a little more loosey-goosey in journalism.
Can we hear some more of it? Yeah, I know
sure,
you've got some articles.
Sure,
yeah.
Here's a description I brought. Nowadays it would be Senator so-and-so has arrived. Instead he did this long thing with all these classical references. Touristy looking under a Panama roof and slightly crabbish-like as to disposition, the sage of Esopus drove in yesterday afternoon. He is refuging in room 318 at the Brown Palace, but you had better knock before entering. Now, here he's referring to a dignitary named Alton B. Parker, but I don't know, I would read beyond that paragraph.
Yeah, that would pull you in.
More so than a paragraph that says, Alton B. Parker of Esopus, New York, has arrived. The things you're hearing here are what Jimmy Breslin once referred to as putting the noise in the news. He captured the sense of, well, this is what it's like to stand in my shoes in 1908 at the Democratic National Convention.
Did he also put a little of the fiction in the news?
Oh, God, yes. I mean, much of what he wrote about the Great White Way in New York kind of novelized
romanticized criminals.
And probably didn't really tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth about the criminal element he was hanging out with. But he captured something.
Right. Well, he also made the other comment that is, whenever you read an article about the 1908 Democratic Convention in Denver, you read the Damon Runyon line where he said that the difference between the Indians and the delegates is that the delegates wore more badges. And he was saying that the delegates were kind of wild. But, of course, it reflects on the Native American Indians.
Right, exactly.
Completely politically incorrect.
Exactly. And, you know, there were still plenty of Indians living in the city. I mean,
and they were not the wild Indians of 50 years before.
No, things had changed.
Yeah. What do you think Runyon would think of, you know, somebody who was, you know, perhaps a little politically incorrect in his day? What do you think
incorrect.
What do you think he would think of this convention?
I think he'd be happy to see that Denver grew up in the way it did. I mean, you know, he was a builder, he was a poet, and he had dreams. I think he would have considered what he sees here a fulfillment of dreams, maybe not his in particular, but, you know, the city had grown from a dusty little mining town into this thing that we see now, where you got the Pepsi Center and Elitch's and a modern version of it. Mm-hmm. You know.
What do you think he would have thought of the candidates, Barack Obama, you know?
Well, I think he definitely would have adopted a kind of a modern, ironic attitude of snark, major league snark. He was a fairly conservative guy, especially in his later years. If you look up what he wrote about Roosevelt during the New Deal, he was not big on Roosevelt, and he probably wouldn't have been big on the Democrats. He loved public spectacle, and I think that's the thing he would have related to here.
We should say he was sober by the age of 30.
The thing that people forget is that he actually found sobriety before he left here. I mean, he learned that technique that I keep in mind even when I do my own journalism today, and I don't mind having a Manhattan at the end of the week. But he learned that if you drank coffee and sat still and listened to people and watched them and really watched them with like the precision of a gem maker, is how Tom Clark put it, you could describe them in such a way as you brought them to life. And that was his M.O., I mean, bringing people to life on the printed page. If you think of seeing as an active verb, then your journalism gets better.
And you think of Damon Runyon when you think of that? You're nodding yes.
I guess I'm drinking my coffee.
Luck be a lady tonight. Luck be a lady tonight. Luck if you've ever been a lady to begin with. Luck be a lady tonight.
By the way, when in Denver, take a trip to Elitch Gardens, as we did. It's just terrific. And the Democrats are hoping that Luck is a lady tonight named Hillary Clinton, and in her speech, she'll unify the party base. Will Senator Clinton's call for party unity be successful? At a Denver hotel on Monday, she said that we are here for one purpose, to give the party momentum going into the general election so that come November, Barack Obama will become the president of the United States. Well, as Damon Runyon would say, I long ago came to the conclusion that all life is 6-5 against. He also said, the race is not always to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, but that's the way to bet. I have no idea what either means or why it might be relevant, but I love how they sound. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again from Denver, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.